Before we begin our study, we'll pause for a few moments of silent prayer. You may use that time for rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Father, we thank you for the freedom we enjoy in this client nation. We thank you that you have preserved it for almost 245 years. It is under assault today from those from the dark side. And we're reminded in the study we now have underway that the dark side has no particular period of history. Because of Luciferian interference, there is also the dark side at every turn of every event. May what we do here in this study remind us of our freedom and those who paid the last full measure in order to ensure its continuance. We lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. The invasion of June the 6th, 1944. Sun Tzu. In general, the Tao, and Tao is a path of virtuous conduct, the art or skill of doing something in harmony. In general, the Tao of the invader is that when one has penetrated deeply into enemy territory, the army will be unified and the defenders will not be able to conquer you. When the soldiers and officers have penetrated deeply, they will not be afraid. Where there is nowhere to go, they will be solid. When they have advanced deeply, they will cling together. When there is no alternative, they will fight. If there is no escape from death, the officers and soldiers will fully exhaust their strength. Deuteronomy 20, verses 3 and 4. Hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted. Do not be afraid or panic or tremble before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies and to save you. Once the invasion was officially underway, a number of people appealed to Eisenhower for permission to board the naval ships in order to witness the attack. Winston Churchill, of course, was one of those. He was refused permission. Among those who refused permission was the Prime Minister of England. He is Eisenhower's account, and therefore the incident is recorded in his book entitled Crusade in Europe. Just get a picture of, I wanted to review who the officers were before we began. It's been a week. Eisenhower was commander-in-chief of the Allied forces in Western Europe. We have Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur William Tedder. He's the deputy commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force. General Omar Nelson Bradley, commander of the 12th Army Group. General Sir Bernard Law Montgomery, commander of the British Canadian 21st Army Group. Lieutenant General Carl Toohey Spatz, chief of the U.S. Bombing Force, Germany. Admiral Sir Bertram Home Ramsey, naval commander in chief of Operation Overlord. Air Marshal Sir Trafford Lee Mallory, Commander-in-Chief of the Allied Expeditionary Air Forces for Operation Overlord. Sir Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Churchill's request was undoubtedly inspired as much by his natural instincts as a warrior as by his impatience at the prospect of sitting quietly back in London to await reports. I argued, however, that the chance of his becoming an accidental casualty was too important from the standpoint of the whole war effort, and I refused his request. He replied with complete accuracy that while I was in sole command of the operation, by virtue of authority delegated to me by both governments, such authority did not include administrative control over the British organization. He said, "Since this is true, it is not part of your responsibility, my dear General, to determine the exact composition of any ship's company in His Majesty's fleet." This being true, he rather slyly continued, by shipping myself as a bona fide member of a ship's complement, it would be beyond your authority to prevent my going. All of this I had ruefully to concede, but I forcefully pointed out that he was adding to my personal burdens in this thwarting of my instructions. Even, however, while I was acknowledging defeat in the matter, aid came from an unexpected source. I later heard that the king had learned of Prime Minister's intention, and while not presuming to interfere with the decision reached by Mr. Churchill, he sent word that if the Prime Minister felt it necessary to go on the expedition, he, the king, felt to be equally his duty and privilege to participate at the head of the troops. This instantly placed a different light on the matter, and I heard no more of it. There's King George the VII, King of the United Kingdom and the dominions of the British Commonwealth. He was going to go first, and then Winston Churchill could follow. Therefore, he trumped the whole idea. By the way, as we move on in this, first of all, you have to have the Pathfinders to go in first, and they do some bombing missions and various number of things behind the German lines at Normandy. I could not get any photographs of these guys actually dropping out of airplanes, and I discovered later that there were photographs on the Normandy side. And when they were sent to be developed, whoever the fellow was that did that made a grave mistake and ruined all of the negatives. And so we don't have the coverage of that. But these are the fellows who were ready to disembark. These are called the Pathfinders, and this was made right before they embarked upon their mission. And so the assault on Normandy began at 12:15 a.m. when the Pathfinders for the American airborne units left their planes and parachuted to earth. 5 minutes later, on the other side of the invasion area, the British Pathfinders made their jump. The Pathfinders were specially trained to find and mark a drop zone. The main airborne assault was to commence within an hour. Because of stiff winds and evasive action by transport pilots to avoid anti-aircraft fire, some paratroopers missed their drop zones by as much as 20 miles. By 3:30 a.m., when the last trooper was down, units were organizing and setting out toward objectives. The mission of the 101st Airborne Division was to seize the area behind Utah Beach, including causeways over flooded areas, in order to facilitate the 4th Infantry Division's advance. The 82nd Airborne was to take San Marigliese, establish and hold the northern and western edges of the airhead, and seize bridgeheads over the Murderet River. This is to facilitate an attack to the west designed to cut the peninsula. The complications occurred here. To complicate matters, the troopers had to contend with hedgerows, earthen dikes, almost 4 feet high, and covered with hedges and trees. I think I turned too many pages. No, I did it right. Enclosing areas smaller than football fields, they made excellent defensive positions. And so this shows you, this map here, best I could find, shows you the pattern of these aircraft as they fly into the Normandy area and drop their men behind the lines here. And they, of course, are busily doing this. As we get into the Normandy area, this is western France, they have these hedgerows that are built along the way all over the place. And you don't know what's on the other side. And you had to fight your way through these things. And therefore, they're alleyways, so to speak. You can go through the area, but you're trapped not knowing what's on the other side or what's on the opposite side of the hedgerow. So this is the kind of thing that gave them a bit of trouble as they moved through the area. This shows you that the area behind the lines, so to speak. These things that you see are German resistance. The little red circles here have to do with German resistance. And so you're very familiar with the people coming in. That's gold, you know, and sword. This is the British and Canadian sector here. And these guys are coming in at this point. They want to take Caen, which is a city, and it's on the Murderet River. And therefore, that is one of the initial objectives by the Allies. So to the east, near the Orne River, members of the British 6th Airborne Division began landing shortly after midnight. The division's mission was to seize two critical bridges over the Orne and parallel Caen Canal, and therefore hold the left flank for the beachhead. They encountered some of the same problems as their American counterparts by being widely dispersed on landing. Now, one Pathfinder team dropped onto the lawn in front of the headquarters of the German 711th Infantry Division and was promptly captured. When taken before the division commander and questioned, one paratrooper replied, "Awful sorry, old man, but we simply landed here by accident." To take critical bridges, the British had created a special task force of volunteers, which landed in six plywood gliders, all but one within 150 yards of the bridges. Capitalizing on surprise, the force captured the bridges in a few minutes and tenaciously held them against several German attacks throughout the next 6 hours. Thus, the Allies were assured of blocking a major east-west route, which the Germans needed in order to move reinforcements. Eisenhower gives some interesting details regarding the battle for the city of Caen. On the eastward flank, the city of Caen did not fall to our initial rush as we had hoped, and we were consequently unable to gain ground south and southeast of the city, where we had planned to make early exploitation of our tank and combat air strength. But the battling in that area reached a sustained and intensive pitch. Rommel defended tenaciously, and as the fighting progressed, it became clear why it was necessary for him to do so. To support the divisions in the attack area, the enemy first drew into the battle zone all the troops he could spare from the Brittany Peninsula. Next, he brought up divisions from the south of France and others from the Low Countries. His only remaining major reserves in northwest Europe not committed to the fighting were in about Calais in the German 15th Army. To maintain connection with these troops, he had to hold Caen. If he lost that city, his two principal forces would be divided and could thenceforth operate together only if both executed a long withdrawal. And so to Caen, he hurried his strongest and best divisions and made every possible preparation to hold it to the end. As quickly as it became certain that the enemy intended at all cost to hang on to Caen as the hinge of his operations, it instantly became to our advantage to keep him so preoccupied in that region that all other Allied operations would be facilitated. Now, as the airborne units struggled to achieve their goals, the great fleet made its way across the channel to its appointment on the beaches of Normandy. The Allied fleet assembled first at Area Z, nicknamed Piccadilly Circus, approximately 10 miles southeast of the Isle of Wight. If you've been to London, I haven't, but this is a photograph of Piccadilly Circus. Some of those of you who have been there know that this is an area where a lot of things go on. And therefore, when these battleships assembled, they called it Piccadilly Circus. And therefore, these ships are going to bring soldiers in to the coast of Normandy. And this is where they rallied all of these ships at a certain point of time. Then they took off, headed toward the shore. And so they started from an area that was nicknamed Piccadilly Circus. Here you can see how the thing is arranged as far as going in is concerned. You have Utah and Omaha with the Americans. You have gold, Juno, and sword made up of first the Brits, then the Canadians, and then the Brits. And so these are the areas populated by these men and soldiers and so on, but the ships are bringing them there. Now what we're going to do as we proceed in our study, we're going to see how these people arrive at their designated areas. And therefore, these various areas here are going to be invaded, and problems will emerge, especially at Omaha Beach. And so these are the guys that are coming in the ships. They're going to be dumped off, as we'll learn in a few minutes, and then they have to take the objective. So never in warfare has such a fleet been assembled before, including the landing craft carried on board. The combined Allied invasion armada numbered up to 5,000 ships. Approximately 150,000 men would cross the channel and land at assault beaches codenamed Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juno, and Sword. Now, regardless of how meticulously a military plan is devised, inevitably unanticipated problems or natural difficulties arise in its execution. Overlord was no exception. Due to adverse weather, minesweepers had difficulty in doing their jobs. As a result, some ships in the following convoys hit mines that had been missed. Weather conditions also affected the embarked troops, for seasickness was rampant. The great effort made to serve good food to troops during their journey unfortunately backfired, because many of them could not keep it down. Some of the men had been on board a week. They were all packed tightly together. Many sanitary facilities could not take the load and malfunctioned, adding to the misery. Due to anticipated fire from enemy guns, the Americans lowered their landing craft some 11 miles out. This 11-mile distance meant that a three-hour ride in a landing craft on choppy seas had to be endured. Men could be seen exchanging addresses before they left their ships, so that if something happened to one, the other could contact the bereaved family. Many prayed. Due to the unsettled seas, the number of the assault troops were injured before they could even get out of their boats. Weather conditions prevailed at the time of H hour, a little better than had been predicted, but far from ideal. The maximum wind was 15 knots and visibility was 3 miles. Now they got dumped off 11 miles out. Due to overcast conditions, bombing was by instrument at Omaha Beach. To prevent bombs from falling on the initial waves of assault boats, Eisenhower had approved a 30-second delay in release time. This resulted in all bombs impacting inland of the coastal defense positions. These bombs did detonate many minefields, which would be beneficial later, but that was of little comfort to the assault troops at this time. The Allied plan called for elements of a corps to land on each of the two American beaches. Utah Beach would be assaulted by the 7th Corps, commanded by Major General J. Lawton Collins, who had led the 25th Infantry Division at Guadalcanal. Major General Leonard T. Gouraud, who was one of the earliest planners of Overlord, commanded the 5th Corps, which would land on Omaha Beach. At Utah Beach, the principle that Jesus Christ controls history came into play once more. When the assault craft encountered a strong southerly current, it caused them, this is the Utah Beach crowd, it caused them to land in the wrong sector. shore defenses that would have contested a landing in the original area would undoubtedly have taken a heavy toll. The landing in the new sector was virtually unopposed. If enemy resistance was relatively light at Utah Beach, such was not the case at Omaha. Omaha Beach, just plain hell, is what it's called. Sun Tzu cast them into positions from which there is nowhere to go, and they will die without retreating. If there is no escape from death, the officers and soldiers will fully exhaust their strength. 1 Samuel 17, verses 45 through 47. David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." On D-Day, it would be the 1st Division 16th Regimental Combat Team and the 29th Division's 116th Regimental Combat Team that would combine in the first wave to hit Omaha. Both RCTs contained a medical, artillery, and engineer unit and were supported by 32 duplex drive tanks. Due to winds and waves, 27 of the 29 tanks that were launched to move in the 16th RCT sank. Two remained in the water and did make it to shore. Three more were landed later. On observing the fate of the 16th Combat Team's tanks, the 116th put theirs on the beach only to fall prey to German artillery fire. Heavy seas took a toll on artillery pieces which the Allies were bringing to shore. Men of this first wave sought whatever cover they could find. Engineered demolition men braved enemy fire to try and destroy the beach obstacles. It appeared that the 5th Corps would never attain its mission of securing the beachhead and linking up with the adjacent British and American units. By H hour plus 30 minutes, the rest of the two assault regiments and two ranger battalions were to arrive. An hour after that, engineer and artillery special brigades were due to land. Units already ashore were fragmented due to the shifting effect of the coastal current and the heavy enemy fire. Only three of the 16 tank dozers were working. You'll see that in the picture on the board. This simply is a tank that's got a way to plow, and therefore they can move through things with great abandon and a clear ways as they move forward. And so the minutes passed, and with them the opportunity to blow up many of the obstacles. And this is because the rising water soon was too deep. That would be the tide. Still, the demolition men did what they could, and by 7 o'clock a.m., six gaps had been marked when the second wave arrived. So heroic were the demolition men in the face of enemy fire that 15 of them were later awarded Distinguished Service Crosses. Many of you remember when Mel and Jane Turner lived in O'Fallon, Illinois. This is before they moved to Arizona some few years ago. Jane's uncle, Raymond E. Lanterman, was a member of the 146th Combat Engineers Battalion. In an essay written in March of 1984, Lieutenant Lanterman documents many of the things we're learning in our study of Omaha Beach. Now, this is a first-person account of landing on Omaha Beach. And this Lieutenant Lanterman wrote this essay. I want to tell you when he did it. He did it in March of 1984. See, that's 20 years after the event occurred. I think you'll find this interesting because this is a first-person account of things that not only he did, but what he endured. He writes the following. The 146th Combat Engineers Battalion arrived in the British Isles in 1943 and early 1944, was stationed at Barnstable Bay in Devonshire, southwest England. Lundy Island, of pirate notoriety, was on the horizon. Our mission was to maintain and to repair the damage done to the nearby training area where troops who would take part in the invasion of France were trained in realistic rehearsals. We watched unit after unit go through the rugged course and were smugly congratulating ourselves on our relatively safe position as the maintenance crew, when to our consternation, early in May, we learned that we were the next unit on the list and that another engineer outfit would be cleaning up after us. As engineers who would be landing early on D-Day, we concentrated on the demolition using explosives of obstacles similar to those the Germans had erected on the coast of Normandy. Landing barges were to take us across the English Channel to France, and we invented a little song, coming in on a barge with a charge, to the tune of coming in on a wing and a prayer. Our training completed, we were isolated a few days before the invasion in a fenced enclosure, no passes outside for anybody, and briefed very thoroughly on that part of Normandy Beach we'd be landing on. For the briefing, we had low and high altitude aerial photographs provided by the Air Force's 34th Reconnaissance Squadron. They, of course, were able to take photographs. This squadron here, as they were airborne, they easily could have been misidentified as enemy aircraft. And one of the ways that the Allies were able to communicate to those on the ground that they were Allied forces, they installed by paint black and white stripes on the aircraft. This is something that was used in order for people on the ground to be able to tell it's friendly aircraft. And so that is an example of that here. There's a little blurb at the top. Invasion stripes were alternating black and white bands painted on the fuselages and wings of Allied aircraft during World War II to reduce the chance that they would be attacked by friendly forces during and after the Normandy landings. Here's another example of it here. You can see that that is on the wings and, of course, the fuselage. And so this is a manner by which they were in the air and safe from Allied attacks. There was also an extremely accurate scale model of Omaha Beach, complete with natural features, trees, houses, and other buildings, and even such German military installations as were known to be in the vicinity. We memorized the landing site and studied the obstacles in the photographs until we knew everything backwards and forwards. Later, when we did land, we discovered just how accurate the model had been. The coast looked just like it, right down to the last detail. Now, about the first day of June, we were taken to Plymouth Harbor in England's south coast, where we were to board the LSTs, the landing ship tanks. You can see Plymouth right here. That's the name of it, but the coastal community is there. So that gives you some idea of Portsmouth, of course, is where the think tank for all of this accumulated. We saw the little house, not little house, the big house in which they made their headquarters. And so Lanterman is over here at this location. It's commanded by Coast Guard officers and moored cheek by jowl all over the place. Each LST assigned to combat engineers carried a tank dozer in addition to its complement of troops. The vessels were equipped with galleys, and a stocky lieutenant from Arkansas who inhabited the one that tied to our port side was a baker by profession, and it wasn't long before we had a row of freshly baked pies laid out along the rail to cool. On the evening of June 4th, we sailed out into the English Channel. As far as the eye could see, in all directions, the sea was filled with landing craft, Navy vessels, supply vessels, and other types of military shipping. We woke up on the morning of June 5th back in Plymouth. Eisenhower had been compelled to order the Armada to turn around and go back because the weather had turned foul, and any attempt to land in France would have been foolhardy, if not impossible. I still marvel that that vast fleet could be controlled in so efficient, orderly, and precise manner. That evening, the 5th, we sailed again and consoled one another by saying this was probably yet another dry run. It wasn't. Before dawn on the 6th, we rendezvoused with a fleet of small landing craft, LCPs, landing craft personnel, each just large enough to hold a platoon of men, steered by coxswain from the Coast Guard. We transferred to our LCP at sea, leaving the largest LST with its tank dozer to come in on its own mission and begin the run to the shore. For a few minutes, the LCPs ran side by side, so close together that we could converse with the people in the neighboring boats. We gradually drew apart, however, spacing out to the prescribed intervals for landing. Our course took us past enormous battleships whose big guns were blasting away in a softening up mission. Great balls of fire and clouds of black smoke belched from her guns as she fired in rapid succession, sending shells screaming over our heads to explode on the mainland of Europe. As we drew near Omaha Beach in the early morning light, we easily recognized the landmarks and features we had seen on a scale model and were beginning to receive fire from shore. At this distance, shells from German 88s, a very sleek and efficient weapon, were plopping into the sea around us, sending up geysers of spume as they exploded in the water. Some boats, of course, were hit. One unfortunate craft blew up when a shell dropped into it and set off the explosives aboard. The timing of each phase of enormously complicated Operation Overlord had been carefully worked out to the last minute. At H hour M minute, the first infantry units were to go ashore. At H hour, plus 5 minutes, we demolition engineers were to land. As thus scheduled, the infantry would be engaging the enemy, hopefully pushing him back, leaving us free to proceed with our mission without the necessity of defending ourselves. The best laid schemes of mice and men. It happened that we arrived first in our particular sector at H hour M minute at lowest tide, about 6 or 6:30 a.m. The LCP went aground before we touched shore, and the coxswain told us he could go no farther. He was stuck on a sandbar. He lowered the ramp, and we saw that we'd have to wade a distance of perhaps 50 to 70 yards to get to the beach. I gave the order to disembark and jumped off the end of the ramp. Loaded with explosives, carbines, binoculars, primer cord, and what all, we sank like stones. Fortunately, the water was only up to our necks. Fortunately, also, there was very little wave action, and we started to wade in. The spatter pattern of a cone of machine gun fire was hitting the water's surface off to our right, and we detoured to the left in order to give it as wide a berth as possible. The cone of fire never moved closer to us, to our relief, and we all made it to the beach intact, where immediately set to work amid the thunk of exploding mortar shells and the whistle of small arms bullets. The intensive training grind we had gone through so recently tended to make robots of us. We could think of nothing but the tasks we were assigned to carry out, and working under withering fire was something we had never experienced before. It was all very unreal. One of our men had been a goof-off and a thorn in our flesh throughout his time in the outfit. He had even tried to climb over the fence in the sealed-off final briefing area to go to town. But here, when the chips were down, he was as calm as if he were in his own backyard at home, going about his assigned duties, completely ignoring the danger as if it were a commonplace thing to work under desperate conditions. The obstacles we demolished were wooden poles standing upright in the sand. Each pole was taller than a man, for tides are deep on that coast, and many had teller anti-tank mines secured to their tops, which at high tide would be awash or perhaps just slightly underwater. Any boats coming in at high tide then would strike the mines and be disabled or destroyed. Our mission was to cut down the poles with explosives, detonating the mines as well, to create a passage through which landing barges coming in could navigate without danger. So I want to show you the poles you can see on the right over here. What you see on the left is the Teller anti-tank mine. What you see on the right is how it's deployed on a wooden pole here. So when there's high tide, it could be sort of in this area or even underwater, so that individuals or equipment or barges, anything that came across these things would explode and therefore wreak devastation on the person that had encountered it. And so these are the things that Lanterman and his crew had to locate, defuse, and then get rid of. And so that is one of the important tasks that Lieutenant Lanterman and his crew had to accomplish as others were coming in behind them. For the demolition work, each of us carried a quantity of pliable explosive substance stuffed into ordinary cotton stockings. We were to route these around the poles close to the ground, then connect them all with primer cord, a kind of explosive rope. The fuse was then attached to a network of cord, fuses, which had been kept waterproof by being sealed in condoms. Just when we had made ready and were about to fire the charge, an infantry detachment landed. We yelled at the colonel, leading them to keep his people back, for they'd be blown to bits if they came forward through the poles just then. He and his men flattened themselves out on the sand, and we pulled the fuse. We must have done something right, for we got a successful blow, the blast of the charge ringing each pole, pitched it into, and they all toppled. The first part of our mission was now completed. We had felled the posts, and the tank dozer could clear them away to create a path through the obstacles, which, in addition to the post, consisted of many X-shaped iron constructions, which were about 2 feet high, fashioned from short lengths of railroad rails. They resembled the jacks children play with, except much larger, you can see. The next task was to search for mines in the sand. The man who carried the mine detector had soon been killed, and I picked up the instrument and began to use it. By now, the tank dozer had arrived and was beginning to clear away the fallen poles and the jacks. I happened to be a few yards in front of the dozer when some unfriendly soul of the Wehrmacht side got a bead on me. I dropped, hit presumably by machine gun fire. That tank dozer is going to run over me, I thought, and tried to move out of the way without much success. Later, in the hospital in England, I saw the driver and he assured me he had seen my fall and wasn't about to run me down. The medic came up, a terribly young-looking boy, and knelt beside me to help. He was burdened with so much gear that he apologized for not being able to reach behind himself to get out medications and bandages. I told him to turn around, tell me what to look for, and I'd fish it out of his bulging knapsack. While we were doing this, he muttered, "Lieutenant, I'm scared defectionless." I assured him he wasn't the only one. The tank Dozier was put out of commission, so there was no more worry about being run over by lying flat on my back. I felt water at my feet and realized that the tide was coming in. Now there was a new danger. I could drown here. I tried to scooch up higher, but the tide was faster than I could move. I owe my life to a couple of men who sized up the situation and helped me to a position above the high water line. Now, it looked as if I might survive, and I wished that I had my movie camera with me, since it was impossible to get up and do anything useful. The morphine which the medic had administered made me groggy, although still quite aware, and I didn't know how long I was there, maybe an hour, before friendly hands put me on a stretcher and carried me to a big landing barge, which had just disgorged its load and was taking wounded aboard. A missile hit its superstructure and splattered fragments around, but we backed out safely and drew alongside a destroyer far out at sea, which took us wounded on and put us in sick bay bunks. Again, I could only marvel at the clockwork precision of this whole operation. If you needed something, say a destroyer, for instance, there it was, waiting for you. Today, 40 years later, an invasion of this sort would simply be impossible, for a single modern nuclear weapon could wipe out such a fleet. The Allies were lucky Germany didn't have an atomic bomb. Raymond E. Lanterman died on January 23rd of 1994, after a lengthy illness. He was 77. At this point, our discussion of Omaha Beach will continue, but I see on the wall we've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left in this first hour, so this turns out to be a very good place to stop, and we'll resume our study on page 25 at about 10 till the hour. Time now for tea and crumpets.